From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Coming up, journalist Donatella Lorch was living outside Kathmandu when that devastating earthquake struck. We'll get an update on the conditions in Nepal.
But first, we go to Baltimore, where six police officers have been charged in the death of Freddie Gray, the 25-year-old African-American who died April 19th of a spinal injury he received while in police custody. Gray's arrest was filmed by a bystander. And at a press conference this morning, Baltimore State Attorney Marilyn Mosby explained why she decided to press charges.
The findings of our comprehensive, thorough, and independent investigation, coupled with the medical examiner's determination that Mr. Gray's death was a homicide, which we received today, has led us to believe that we have probable cause to file criminal charges.
You hear reaction there from members of the Baltimore community who were at Marilyn Mosby's announcement. Reporter Kenny Burns of WYPR was at the press conference and joins us on the line now. Kenny, can you first tell us about the charges against these six police officers? What exactly are they facing?
Well, one of the officers, the van driver, Officer Cesar Goodsing Jr., he is facing probably the he's the only one from what I could tell is from what they handed out that he is facing a murder charge, second-degree murder, which faces up to a 30-year sentence. But for the most part, everyone is facing a misconduct, an office charge, and an assault charge, a secondary assault charge, as well as a manslaughter in the incident of Freddie Gray.
And I see that that second-degree murder charge can carry a penalty of up to 30 years. The manslaughter charge is up to 10 years. Attorney Mosby said that the arrest of Freddie Gray also lacked probable cause. What specifically did she say about that?
Specifically, officers said they found a knife on Freddie Gray, but under Maryland law, the type of knife that Freddie Gray had was not illegal. So that's how that determination of improbable cause to hold Freddie Gray in custody came about.
Well, as we heard in that bit of tape that we played a little bit earlier, there was obviously immediate and visceral reaction from members of the community in Baltimore. Marilyn Mosby had specific things to say to folks in the community. She addressed the public after she announced the charges, and this is what she said.
To the people of Baltimore and the demonstrators across America, I heard your call for no justice, no peace. Your peace is sincerely needed as I work to deliver justice on behalf of this young man.
So, Kenny, what is it like in Baltimore right now where you are? What have people been telling you?
People are, quite frankly, they're happy that charges are being pressed against these officers. But particularly Helen Holden, she's a councilwoman on the Baltimore City Council. She said that it's been a long time coming in regards to charges that have been filed and just some of the questionable practices of some police officers that this particular community, the Sandtown neighborhood in West Baltimore, has said all along. I spoke with one resident. He works in the city. He's concerned about what's going to happen with the verdict either way. Well, if the officers are found guilty, what happens to the city? If the officers are found not guilty, what happens to the city? So some are thinking ahead to what will happen at trial.
And Kenny, just briefly, I also noticed that Marilyn Mosby went out of her way to say that she comes from a family that has five generations of law enforcement in her family and that this is not an indictment against the Baltimore police as a whole. Do you think that will resonate with the police officers who are out on the street today?
It's hard to tell. We will find out in time, sure enough. But keep in mind, not only does she come from generations of Boston police officers, she's from Boston, but her cousin was killed, and going through that situation and seeing officers take care of just going through that process and seeing the conviction for her cousin being killed, that prompted her to be a prosecutor as a whole. So she has a lot of respect for law enforcement.
Kenny Burns of WYPR speaking to us in Baltimore. Kenny, thank you so much.
Thank you, Meghna.
In Nepal, the death toll has risen to more than 6,000 after Saturday's massive earthquake. Officials worried about the disposal of the bodies have ordered immediate cremations and say rebuilding will cost $2 billion. For the living, some help is finally making its way into the hardest-hit regions in rural Nepal. And a warning to our listeners, some of the language in this next conversation may not be suitable for children. Donatella Lorch is a longtime foreign correspondent. She lives with her family outside Kathmandu. Donatella, welcome.
Thank you.
And first, you wrote this week that you knew life would be getting worse in the days and weeks that followed the quake. What is it like there now?
Well, I mean, on the positive side, the government, the one major thing the government has done is trying to reinstitute as much electricity as possible into the villages and into the bigger city area, which is a huge help. Mm. Over 100,000 people are living on the streets right now because they can't re-enter their houses because either the houses have been destroyed or they're too unstable to go back in. And unfortunately, the rainy season has started early here. So it's torrential most every day or night. Aside from that, their big issue is aid getting out. There's massive amounts of aid coming into the airport. I mean, the flights are nonstop.
And there's been some question about whether or not the government is prepared to deal with this. Is the aid that's coming in actually getting distributed to people who need it?
Not as far as I know. The government is in a state of flux. No one really knows who's in control, who's deciding where it's going. It's different from Haiti in the sense that basically the U.S. government took over in Haiti and said, you're going here, you're going there. But in Nepal, it's a sovereign nation. I went to a town right outside from where I live. It's in the southern edge of the valley. I would estimate that more than 60% of the town is destroyed. It's horrendous. Mm. It's heartbreaking. The buildings are just crumbling in every single direction. Aid workers have been landing in Nepal with huge planes with massive amounts of tents and food and everything else, and none of it, not a single foreigner, has entered this town with aid. And it is 12 kilometers from the airport.
Just unbelievable. And you've said that you, in your mind, for a long time, had tried to prepare with this. You say you were obsessed with the possibility of a major quake hitting. And you even had go-packs with documents and supplies in them scattered around your house. But I wonder, when you actually see what you're witnessing there, if anything that you could possibly do to prepare actually prepares you for what you've seen.
Well, nothing prepares you for the constant fear and anxiety and the relentless aftershocks. No matter how many, go-packs you have and whether we're living in a tent right now. My son, my 10-year-old son, does not want to enter at all into the house. He is so terrified of what's going to go on. But the issue is, I have prepared enough that I have food and water to last for a few weeks. Many people here do not have that. Most people here do not have that.
For all the tragedy and the difficulties getting aid to people and relief, talk about some of the kindnesses that people are showing to each other that we've been reading about.
Oh, this is one of the most wonderful things about Nepal, is from day one, from the afternoon of the earthquake, I walked down my street to one of the most destroyed towns in the valley, and people had already set up their little makeshift tents, and they all welcomed me. They said, our food is your food. Our tent is your tent. Please feel free to come join us if you need anything. I mean, the Nepalis are amazing people because they know they have to survive despite their government. And they rely on their relationships with their friends, with their villages. They're very complex relationships. They're called gutis here. You know, it's religious relationships. It's work relationships, various businesses. And they're all interrelated, and that's what makes them thrive.
You've reported from all over the Middle East, Asia, from war zones. As a reporter, as someone who's seen destruction many times in your career, how does this compare?
The destruction is the worst I've ever seen, by far the worst. And it's much more terrifying in a way than being shot at, because it's so unpredictable, because you don't know when nature is going to turn on you. And there was a rumor going around on the radio that totally freaked out my 10-year-old, which was that there was a massive earthquake happening in 1 hour. And I told Lucas, you know, you may be only 10 years old, but you are going to be allowed tonight to scream out as loud as you can, bold. This is not going to happen. And he smiled and laughed and screamed it as fast as he could.
Have you had any temptations to get him out?
My take on life is, this is the reality. And he's surrounded by people who love him, who want to make him feel safe. He doesn't want to leave here. And I understand that because earthquake is what our life is about. And he knows what it is. He has his friends that are involved in it. He has people that work for us that are involved in this. And, you know, I don't believe in hiding the realities of the world to my children.
Yeah. Donatella Lorch, a longtime foreign correspondent and freelance journalist, speaking to us from her home outside Kathmandu. Donatella, thank you so much.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you.
The violence in Baltimore reverberated through presidential politics this week. Candidates had to square their past stances on law enforcement with current protests. That and a former Chris Christie confidant pleads guilty in the Bridgegate scandal. Hillary Clinton now has a challenger in the Democratic primary. And Carly Fiorina gets ready to become the second woman in the race. So there is a lot of 2016 news to check in on. Let's jump in with Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Hi there, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you.
Great to have you. And Wesley Lowery, national reporter for The Washington Post. Hi there, Wesley.
How are you guys doing? Thanks for having me.
Great to have you as well, Wesley. And let's just start with you. You cover law enforcement and communities for The Post. First of all, let's get your thoughts on the fact that Baltimore State Attorney Marilyn Mosby has decided to charge six Baltimore officers in the case of Freddie Gray.
Well, it's certainly noteworthy. I mean, to start with, what we know is that very rarely are officers charged anywhere in the country when someone is killed on duty, whether that's in custody or during a shooting. And so the idea that six officers would be charged really is noteworthy. And so that's something that is certainly reverberating throughout the country right now. It's certainly a moment here in this ongoing conversation we're having on policing in the United States. But pivoting it forward, we still have to wait and see what happens. Charges are one thing. Actual convictions are very different. And there's a long time between now and when these officers might actually face these charges.
Right. Rick, I mean, imagine everybody who has to deal with politics and policy is doing exactly what Wesley's saying, kind of watching and waiting at the moment.
It has upended the political system. It forced Hillary Clinton to make an earlier statement on policy than she had, her campaign had anticipated. This was supposed to be a quiet rollout. Instead, she's out there with a major speech. It's had some Republicans a little bit tentative. I think Rand Paul with a statement that was a little off key where he joked with an interviewer he was just glad his train didn't stop in Baltimore the other day. And then I think it really puts Governor Martin O'Malley, the former governor and mayor of Baltimore, former governor of Maryland, in the spotlight. His policing policies, a lot of folks feel like, led to some of the concerns that we're now seeing. And that's been a critical piece of his resume. So we've seen him in the midst, in the mix, in Baltimore, on the streets. So I think the politics are always secondary in these situations. But clearly we're in a moment. And this may be one of those big defining issues that charts out different territory for the candidates and also just resonates with voters around the country.
Right. I mean, Rick, you covered a lot of ground there. We actually have some tape from things that you mentioned. Here's Rand Paul on the Laura Ingraham Show on Tuesday night.
It's sad. It's scary. I came through the train on Baltimore last night. I'm glad the train didn't stop. But the thing is that really there are so many things we can talk about, mm-hmm. but I think it's something we talk about not in the immediate aftermath, but over time. You know, the breakdown of the family structure, the lack of fathers, the lack of sort of a moral code in our society.
Well, that was Rand Paul on the Laura Ingraham Show on Tuesday night. But the fact that politics and policy are flowing through this moment was even obvious today as Baltimore State Attorney Marilyn Mosby was announcing that she's pressing charges against those six officers because she talked about what this moment signifies, too. So let's listen.
Let's ensure that we have peaceful and productive rallies that will develop structural and systemic changes for generations to come. You're at the forefront of this cause. And as young people, our time is now.
Wesley, I mean, those are sort of two poles in terms of the policy and the structural issues at play here, not just in Baltimore, but across the country. How do you think that that's going to resonate as we push forward in this presidential cycle?
Of course. I think this is something that is going to have to be discussed in the presidential cycle. As Rick noted, it was so noteworthy that Hillary Clinton, in her first address as a candidate, her first real speech, focused very heavily on these issues. But it is, in some ways, a minefield for candidates on both sides, the Republicans and the Democrats. For the Democrats, you've got Hillary Clinton, who's going to have to essentially repudiate many of the criminal justice stances of her husband, President Bill Clinton. You have Martin O'Malley, who many people on the ground in Baltimore personally blame for the distrust because of the aggressive policing policies underneath him. And on the right, while you see a lot of push for criminal justice reform right now, this is a slate of candidates who run as Reagan Republicans. And when we're being honest about what a lot of the criminal justice reform calls for, it calls for the undoing of many of the Reagan drug war policies. And so it is a little politically fraught for everyone.
Mm. Well, you mentioned Hillary Clinton, and we've talked about her a little bit, but we do have some tape from that policy speech she gave on criminal justice reform.
Let's take on the broader inequities in our society. We can't separate the unrest we see on our streets from the cycles of poverty and despair that hollow out those neighborhoods. Despite all the progress we've made in our country, lifting people up, and it has been extraordinary, too many of our fellow citizens are still left out.
Rick, both you and Wesley have mentioned the fact that Hillary Clinton didn't talk about the fact that many of the policies of mass incarceration were enacted under her husband, Bill Clinton. Is that going to come back to haunt her?
I wouldn't expect her to mention it, but I can't expect her to be able to avoid it either. And if for no other reason that she's going to face a Democratic primary challenger, as we learned this week, it's going to come up. It's a different time. And I think you'll hear some variation of that response, whether you're Martin O'Malley or Hillary Clinton talking about the 1990s and the 2000s. It was a different time. And we saw as a society a reaction in a different direction. But it is an irony, perhaps, and something that other candidates are very quick to point out, that you can trace the policing tactics that took hold in some of the big cities of the 1990s to the concerns now about mass incarceration, about sentencing reform and sentencing injustices. So I'm curious on a whole host of issues how Hillary Clinton comes to account. Do we have a kind of big moment where she breaks from the 1990s Clinton era and defines Clintonism for a new century, for a new decade, for a new campaign? That will be a big question that overhangs the campaign. In the meantime, there will be smaller places around the margins where she is distancing herself from her husband's administration, but not doing it in an explicit way. I don't think at any point she'll say, it's too bad President Clinton didn't do this. I think we'll hear more about the evolving nature of American democracy.
Okay, well, let's talk about one of the people who might sort of be a nudging force, for lack of a better term. That's Bernie Sanders from Vermont, who has been talking about income inequality, social inequality for many, many years. He's announced that he's going to enter the Democratic presidential race. So let's listen.
The question is, if you raise the issues that are on the hearts and minds of the American people, if you try to put together a movement which says we have got to stand together as a people and say that this capital, this beautiful capital, our country belonged to all of us and not the billionaire class, that's not raising an issue. That is winning elections. That's where the American people are.
Now, Rick, this is a message that obviously has an incredible amount of resonance amongst certain Democrats. Is Sanders going to now force Hillary Clinton to talk even more about income inequality, about Wall Street, about these economic issues at the heart of the progressive wing of the party?
Yes. And you hear in his voice that passion, that personal commitment that has colored his entire political career. There's something compelling about that. And not just among progressives, although clearly I think his ceiling is limited by his politics and he will appeal to liberals. He will not almost certainly win the Democratic nomination or become president. But he will force the conversation. He will push on economic issues, on social issues, on issues of criminal justice reform included. He will push the conversation to the left. Hillary Clinton will have to navigate that. No doubt. Doesn't mean that it's a threat for the nomination, but the election is about more than who wins. And this debate that we're going to see play out on all of these issues will be colored by the very forceful rhetoric of Bernie Sanders.
Wesley, your thoughts on this?
Definitely. I think that certainly the reason Bernie Sanders or a candidate like Bernie Sanders gets into this race is in part to try to force these issues and push Hillary Clinton to the left and make her address on public debate stages and in her own campaign and policy rhetoric, address these issues that are so important to him, income inequality, dealing with corporations and dealing with Wall Street. But as Rick says, someone like Bernie Sanders deals with quite a ceiling in terms of his actual ability to influence the race.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about someone who's going to enter the race next week on the Republican side. That is former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina. She does have some baggage. She was let go from HP. She has an ex-husband who called her the ultimate clown in the Republican Party clown car. Rick, your thoughts on what she adds to the Republican field?
She's a woman, for starters, and she'll likely be the only woman on those Republican debate stages. And to hear her tell it, it's important for the Republican Party to put forward a woman. As she likes to say, it takes a quiver out of Hillary Clinton's arrow. You can't play the sexism card if she's there. No doubt she'll have a lot to overcome. It's not ideal to have an ex or an ex-corporate board out there talking smack about you over the course of a campaign. But I think she'll be taken seriously because of her business record, because of the different set of skills that she brings, not having held a public office, having been in the corporate world in the past. And again, offering that contrast with Hillary Clinton, she has been about as aggressive as any Republican so far in saying this is what Hillary Clinton does wrong and squaring up against her very personally.
Mm. And Wesley, your thoughts on a Carly Fiorina run?
Yeah, no, I thought Rick made a really great point there, this idea that her experience contrasts very sharply so many of the other candidates. And so it's going to be really interesting. I think she's going to be taken seriously. Now, exactly what is her ceiling? She might also have a Bernie Sanders problem, but right. I do think she's going to be taken seriously.
Wesley Lowery is a national reporter for The Washington Post. Wesley, great to talk to you. Thank you so very much.
Thanks for having me.
And Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Always great to talk to you, Rick.
I enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
And let's take a look at how the news of the week is coursing through social media. Julia Turner is editor-in-chief at Slate, and she joins us from New York. Hi, Julia.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So what caught your attention this week?
Well, one key story rising out of the Freddie Gray protests and the violence in Baltimore has been the story of Toya Graham, who is a mother who was captured on video wailing on her son in an effort to prevent him from throwing a rock at the police. The video captured this very fraught moment within this family. And somewhat predictably, various political factions have adopted it and used it to make cheap political points.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need more of this kind of mom in America. People should control their children. And some people are calling her hashtag mom of the year.
Well, we actually do have some sound from the video. It's depending on your perspective, it's easy or not easy to watch because you do see Toya Graham chasing after her son. She's hitting him, slapping him, and trying to pull off the mask that he's wearing. So let's listen.
Get over here, nut! Did you hear what I said?
And I understand that Toya Graham actually told CBS later that what she was trying to do essentially was to protect her son. She saw him with the rock and was worrying about police retaliation and, quote, didn't want him to be another Freddie Gray. I mean, so it seems like on social media, though, people are kind of projecting their own values onto her.
Yeah, a number of people are very sympathetic to that explanation, and it makes a lot of sense. To me, what's dismaying is there's an ease with which social media allows people to take personal stories and very glibly capitalize on them to make whatever point they want to make about themselves or politics or America. And it seems to me like social media at its worst.
So there is a lot of discussion in social media this week about race and violence. But if we may, since it is a Friday, let's end on something a little bit lighter. Can you tell us about hashtag how old robot? This might be my favorite thing of the week.
This was pretty enjoyable. Some researchers at Microsoft invented a robot that can guess your age based on a photograph. And one of the things that's most charming about this robot is that although this seems like exactly the sort of thing you might build if you were trying to create a viral phenomenon, the researchers behind it did not seem to think about it that way at all. They were hoping maybe 50 people would try it to help confirm their results. They anticipated that users would just scan through a set of stock photographs. Instead, of course, people uploaded photos of themselves, photos of their dogs, photos of their children. I saw someone uploading two comparative portraits of Dorian Gray.
Oh, my God.
to get the answers.
I saw the Mona Lisa on there, too.
How old did it say she was?
30.
That sounds plausible.
I mean, it feels like the folks at Microsoft may know a lot about machine learning, but they don't know anything about human psychology because, I mean, it's perfect for virality, right? It's asking you to do something that reflects information about you back to yourself. And it's really flattering, I have to say, because I tried it and it said that it thinks I'm a man, wrong, but it also thinks I'm 27, which is sadly wrong. But
a strapping young fellow. Yeah, one of our tech bloggers, Lily Newman, who wrote about it, said that the researchers vastly underestimated the narcissism of the internet, and I think that seems correct.
Julia Turner is editor-in-chief at Slate. Julia, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
A new novel called The Fisherman tells the story of four brothers in Nigeria who find themselves in the grip of a terrible prophecy. One day on a forbidden fishing trip, a local madman tells the eldest boy he will be killed by one of his brothers. The tale that unfolds is reminiscent of the biblical story of Cain and Abel. The Fisherman is Chigozie Obioma's debut novel. The Nigerian-born author joins me now. In Chigozie, the Omiala River, where the brothers fish, becomes a fearsome character in your book. Why is that?
So rivers and water bodies are something that are very sacred in African culture. That Omiala, that river that snakes through the length and breadth of the town, actually was at one time seen as a river of value. So there are gods. There is this water spirit or ancestral spirit called the Yemoja, who was believed to live there. Civilization comes and erode the traditional culture of the people. Some of these things are forgotten. So those sentiments die away, because the people now are mostly Christians or Muslims. And so when certain things like, bodies being found in the river happens, people now completely abhor the river and think it's not a place where nobody should go.
And you write about something that was once sacred that becomes essentially defiled. And it does bring to mind the references to Christianity that you have all the way throughout this book. There's a line that stayed with me near the beginning when the boy's mother finds out they've been taking secret trips to this dangerous river to fish. And she says, "The eye that mocks a father that scorns an aged mother will be pecked out by the ravens of the valley, will be eaten by the vulture." And
right.
Ben, the narrator of the story, says those lines from Proverbs are the most frightening in the Bible. I wonder, what role did you want religion to play in your book?
So, Peter, I've been trying to grapple with these paradox that African countries like Nigeria, how is it that although we have become British children with surrogate mothers, how is it that we still have and actually believe somewhat in our ancestral cultures? And, the family is extremely Christian, but still they believe in these things. They believe that this river has this thing, that Abulu is who he claims to be.
Abulu is the madman.
The madman. So religion is a very essential, part of people's lives, and so are these characters. So I'm trying to explore, can we have both together? And I mean the ancestral traditions of, that is very African, and the Western imposed or acquired, values of Christianity.
Right. And maybe politics, it follows closely along with this. I don't want to give too much away from this book, but suffice it to say that the brothers, who are once very close, are completely ripped apart. And it sounds to me like whether it's through religion or whether it's through the politics that weaves its way throughout this book, that you are trying to say something much larger about the state of your country. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. It is, in fact, a commentary. I mean, the novel, the germ of the idea came to me when I was living away from Nigeria. in a kind of what I like to call literary exile. You know, I wasn't made. Nobody forced me out. I left on my own. Mm-hmm. You know, so I was in Cyprus and living in this far-flung place where nobody knew. And I was missing home a lot because I have 7 brothers. We're 12 children. So we make this joke that we are a soccer team and one reserve, you know. Yeah. One day, my dad and I were talking on the phone, and he told me about the increasing closeness between my 2 oldest brothers, who they used to have this very serious sibling rivalry, and they would fight, you know, at times. And no one thought they would ever get along. But now in their early 30s, they'd become so close that they did everything together. So I started to think after that call in 2009 that I would create this closed-knit entity, maybe a family or just about any organization at all, and then try to explore what is it that can come between them and tear them apart. Mm. So that was where the idea of that family came. So, and then I had been reading this book by an American historian, Will Durant, about the great civilizations. And there was this concurrent statement he kept making that a great civilization cannot be destroyed from the outside, has come from within. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was a perfect thing for me to now have this family as a kind of allegory for an entity like Nigeria, where you had these disparate states, and then an external force like Abulu comes in and says, be a country, be this way. And then, you know, we believe it, and we are running an unsustainable country that is not working based on the ideas of the external force that was British.
And Chigozie, your timing, I don't know if you did this on purpose or not, but as you know, later this month, Muhammadu Buhari, Nigeria's president-elect, will be taking power from Goodluck Jonathan. It's a historic transfer of power.
Absolutely.
Buhari, a former military dictator, you know, he was essentially voted into office because people were optimistic that he had what it take to fight the jihadist group Boko Haram, the group that's been absolutely terrorizing the country. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, so I think Chinua Achebe, the great Nigerian writer, was at his most proverbial when he said that a person who does not know where the rain started beating him cannot know how to hide from the rain. So we first have to go back. We have to see where our problem really is. And I think that it is in the foundation of the country itself. It is the very idea of Nigeria. And I'm not the only one who has been calling for us to take a step back, dismantle this contraption that was made by the British, and then assess by ourselves, can we sustain a country that's Nigeria? And if yes, on what terms? You know, it's a good thing that there was, in fact, a very successful transition of government. But what is he going to do? He cannot be a miracle worker. You know, I think he would just continue to run a country that cannot be sustained, I think. Mm.
You brought him up, so I will too. You have been called the heir to Chinua Achebe. You know, this is one of the most famous African authors, the most famous authors of the last 100 years. What do you do with something like that? You're not even 30 years old.
You know, Peter, I was embarrassed by that, you know, because, you know, that guy was, as you said, he was very great. He single-handedly started what is African literature in English as we know it now, especially through his African Writers series. He published more than 200 books and made so many writers. And I think it's a garment that I don't hope to try to put on myself if that accolade, you know, gets me some readers. I'm happy, but I don't think that I see myself as the heir to Achebe, no. Mm.
Who are your readers? Are they Americans or Nigerians?
Just about anybody who is interested in literature. You know, I've always been afraid as to whether people would approach my work because of its content, not its form. Perhaps they'll say something like, I want to read this novel by this African writer because I want to understand Africa. I want to, or I find Africa exotic. No, then what you'd be doing would be not actually coming to my work because it is actually a work of art. I want anyone who is interested in reading a novel to read my work. You know, I don't have a specific audience, even though I am aware, you know, the Nigerians or the Africans might identify more with the story than you would a foreigner.
Chigozie Obioma talking about his debut novel, The Fisherman. Chigozie, thank you for this book and thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
And we have an excerpt from that book, The Fisherman, at our website, herenow.org.
An unusual bipartisan coalition is forming in Congress. It's coming together to overhaul the Patriot Act. The proposed changes are significant, including limiting the NSA's ability to bulk collect internet and phone records, programs exposed by Edward Snowden 2 years ago. David Wellna is NPR's national security correspondent. He's with us now from Washington. Hi there, David.
Hi, Meghna.
So the new bill is called the USA Freedom Act. And let's talk about the first way in which it departs from the Patriot Act, that bulk collection of internet and phone records. How is it different?
Well, you know, the National Security Agency has been bulk collecting people's calling records and storing them for 5 years. This is something that was revealed by Edward Snowden. And under this new bill, the USA Freedom Act, those records would be held only by the phone companies, not by the NSA. And if the NSA wants to track any calling activity, it will have to use very narrowly tailored criteria, not sweeping categories such as all calls from entire area codes or calls made in certain states. And it will have to get a warrant to do so from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court. Now, that highly secret court has granted virtually every request made to it in the past. But with this bill, for the first time, there would be a civil liberties advocate present in the courtroom to challenge the NSA's requests. And every significant decision that court makes would have to be made public, which has not been the case up to now, and which is also why many lawmakers said they had no idea until Snowden spilled the beans that this court had approved the NSA's bulk collection.
Wow. So, I mean, these changes that you mentioned to the FISA court seem very significant. I mean, the secret courts have long been a major concern for civil libertarians.
Indeed.
So I understand that the bill also proposes major changes to those national security letters that give the FBI power to compel banks and telecom companies to disclose customer records. What are the proposed changes there?
Well, yes, these are virtually subpoenas. And, you know, one of the problems with these letters in the past has been that they are accompanied by gag orders, which say basically that the person who gets sent one of these letters cannot tell anyone that he or she has received it and can't reveal to shareholders that this information is being shared. This bill gives it sets much more stringent criteria for when gag orders can be issued, and it also gives those who receive these letters more ability to challenge their propriety in court. And that would be a very healthy change in the eyes of civil libertarians.
So bulk collection, national security letters, the FISA courts, three major provisions in the Patriot Act. But what does the USA Freedom Act not change?
Well, you know, there are things in this bill that civil libertarians say should have been changed as well. This is not a complete overhaul of the Patriot Act. It largely addresses just one provision that's expiring at the end of the month, the one that allows bulk collection of phone records, and that's known as Section 215. There's another Section 702 that allows the NSA to collect emails and other online data overseas, and there are concerns that Americans' communications are being swept up under that provision, but that Section 702 won't come up for renewal for a couple more years. And even though some House members did try to amend the USA Freedom Act yesterday to stop that kind of bulk collection, the bill's sponsors prevailed in keeping it free of any amendments for fear that the whole negotiated package could fall apart if any changes were made to it. It was one of those don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good arguments. They said it's better to have some protections added to the Patriot Act than to have none at all, which might be the case if this bill got stalled.
Now, I understand that a similar bill actually did pass the House last year, but failed in the Senate.
Why does the overhaul seem to be gaining steam now? I mean, we're talking about an unusual bipartisan coalition forming around it.
That's true. And, you know, in a way, it's kind of surprising that this is getting a second wind, since Republicans now control both chambers of Congress. And they've been the ones in the past who've defended the tough surveillance policies that were authorized by the post-9/11 Patriot Act. But a lot of Republicans mistrust President Obama, probably more this year than last year. So they're more inclined with him in the White House to rein in surveillance than they were when George W. Bush occupied the Oval Office. Democrats have been much more inclined to worry about encroachments on civil liberties. Republicans are now making the argument that this USA Freedom Act is actually defending the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution, which forbids unreasonable searches and seizures and says no warrant can be issued without probable cause. One other thing, this bulk collection provision has in the past come up for periodic renewal by Congress, but it wasn't until Snowden made it public that lawmakers felt they had to change that provision, as they're trying to do now, largely in response to popular demand.
Hmm. And finally, David, just briefly, Congress has until June 1st to act. Are there any other competing bills on this front?
Yes. Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell has a bill that would simply extend this bulk collection for 5 more years. That doesn't seem to have a lot of legs, but he's got a lot of power in the Senate, so it could be a showdown that doesn't get resolved until the last minute.
NPR's national security correspondent David Wellna. David, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And we can't end this week without bidding a very fond farewell and best of everything to our Washington intern, Ebony Joseph.
Aww.
She's headed back to her South Florida home and a stint as a reporter at Here and Now contributor WLRN in Miami.
Ebony, thank you very much. Good luck in Florida. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Megan Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.